Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery in the community. And like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and going to skip out on the calendar this week, but you can go to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website, and you can get a listing of all the events and meeting schedules, etc., etc. And today, in the conference room slash studio with me, is Valerie Russo. Valerie is a long-suffering counselor in the Moscow and Pullman area. She's worked with the University of Idaho and Washington State University, as well as some private concerns, but I'll let her talk about that. Welcome, Valerie. I'm glad
Thank
you're here.
You. Yes,
glad to be here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, how you wound up in the wild and crazy world of Moscow Pullman, and then we'll talk a little bit about what you did.
Well, I ended up in the Moscow Pullman area about 30 years ago next month. So I'm in love with the Palouse. I was when I visited it and had a chance to move up here in 1995. And I tagged along with some friends that were making the big move. And so I came up here with just the faith that somewhere somebody would have the perfect job for me, and they did. So that was my start at the University of Idaho in a sexual assault programming coordinator position. So that was many years ago.
Right. And see what happens when you offer to help people move?
Right.
Well, why don't you help us unload, too? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is nice. Why don't we talk a little bit about your professional background. I would post your CV with this, but you know, it's only a 45-minute show, so we might go a little overtime. But why don't you go ahead and talk about that, because I find it fascinating.
Okay. Well, there's a story that my mom used to tell, and I think it's just the beginning of how I got into the helping profession. So I was in kindergarten, and she walked me to the door and was going to say goodbye, but I walked right in by myself, went straight to the little child that was crying, patted them on the back, knelt down, and started telling them that their mommy was coming back. So don't worry, everything was going to be okay. And she said, just turned around and went home. And that was kind of the beginning of, I will go to the people that need the help. So that was when I was five.
When I was five.
Right? So, you know, I, as an adult learner, I mean, it took me all my adult years, basically, it feels like, to finish school, because I went to school forever. So my undergrad degree in human development, and I have a master's in clinical psych. I got a PhD from the University of Idaho in higher education administration with an emphasis on health and wellness, and my cognate expertise area was counseling. I currently still have my professional counseling clinical license for Washington and Idaho, and I'm a certified professional life coach, and I've also been in trained in mental health integrative medicine, which is just a holistic kind of view of mind, body, and soul.
Right, right, yeah. We've had people that have given little mini classes on using that type of thing here at the Recovery Center, and people have really enjoyed it. So I may find a future for you as well. Yeah. See what you get for coming in. Going to find out all your secrets. Well, that's all fantastic. Now, when you started out, or I remember you telling me at some point, I have to preface this, I guess, a little bit. I've known Valerie for a couple of years now, I think, and we both work out at the Martin Wellness Center. So we have a chance to chat when we run into each other because our timing is about the same. You worked in California for...
I worked at a district attorney's office.
District attorney's office, yes. That's right.
Yes, so I was finishing up my master's degree and working a couple different jobs. So I worked at a rape crisis center. I worked at the victim witness office as their sexual assault case coordinator, which was connected to the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm. And it was a vertical prosecution unit. So it was a grant, and it was in the early days, the mid to late 80s, when things were just getting organized for SART, sexual assault response teams. So the vertical prosecution unit was kind of a pilot program when a police report was filed and it made it to the courts and made it to the district attorney's office. A victim that came in saw a criminal investigator, myself or another person, a coordinator, and an attorney, and we stayed with them all the way through sentencing. So every time they came in for an interview or whatever, it didn't matter, went to court, different hearings and things, they saw the same people. They didn't Right. get passed around to different attorneys or investigators or coordinators. So that there was some continuity in that. So I worked a felony sex crimes vertical prosecution unit, which was pretty intense, which got me thinking about maybe I don't want to be the frontline crisis person for the rest of my life, which is how I ended up going to graduate school in Santa Barbara and getting my master's in clinical psych. I thought maybe it would be better to just have one focus instead of working with the police, going to the hospital, going to the courts. And it was a pretty intense kind of dynamic job in the sense that you were involved in everything because I had the three different jobs. So
right. I can imagine the burnout was probably not far away in that type of environment.
Correct.
Especially down in California. What area did you say this was in?
This was in San Luis Obispo. And okay. So the district attorney's office took in police reports from, I'm not going to have the correct number, but yeah. seven or eight different police agencies, sheriffs, right. California Men's Colony, Atascadero State Hospital,
right.
California Youth Authority. I mean, it was a large area.
Right. Yeah, San Luis Obispo, that's Cal Poly is down
correct.
There. So, yeah, it seems like for some reason when you see stories about rape, a university is not far behind and almost always a part of the story. In this area, I've noticed that. Of course, we're sandwiched with two universities here, so
correct.
Maybe it just shows up more on my radar. So,
well, we have more of the high-risk age group here, so right. we will see it more.
Right. And then moving on from there, you helped the people move to Moscow and got
right.
stranded, so you looked for a job, and you landed at?
The University of Idaho. And so I was there for 16 years in various capacities, and while I was there, I finished up my counseling license for Idaho and my PhD, and I was assistant dean of students and of crisis services and resources, and then director of violence prevention programs. So it was.
So you're back in the frying pan again?
Correct. I was back in the frying pan again. And it was a good 16 years. We grew a lot of programs, a lot of national attention to the programs, put U of I in the map in a different way. It was exciting. We garnered a Department of Justice Violence Against Women grant for several years, and that afforded the opportunity for the university to participate in a lot of programming nationally and regionally. And so we grew, myself and the folks that I worked with, a pretty good program. And after about 16 years, I was thinking, maybe I want to narrow my focus again. And so I took a job with a behavioral health, mental health company here in Moscow, and worked with them for about 3 years or so, three or 4 years. And
that was Alliance?
Alliance Family Services,
right.
and then it turned into Sequel.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a good run. I really enjoyed that job and the people and all the different opportunities I had with the clients. And then again, I thought, I kind of miss the rhythm of the campus. So then I landed over at Washington State University, beginning in the Career Center over there, which was a lovely job. I loved those people so much. And it was a part-time position. So again, I was a little antsy, just like, I maybe need a bigger job, which, why do I always say that?
Because not enough children to pat on the back, evidently.
Correct.
Tell them,
yes,
mom's going to be back for you. Don't worry.
Right? Yeah. So then I ended up with basically my dream job, which was a counselor in the College of Veterinary Medicine, working with veterinary students and the teaching hospital residents and interns. So that turned into a very big job. I also oversaw the pet loss hotline while that was running. I had about 50 students that helped me run the pet loss hotline. Taught a practicum with a veterinarian, and so that was a good delve into veterinary medicine, which I just loved. And animals are kind of really close to my heart, so I enjoyed working with the veterinary students.
Right.
And I worked until I was ready to retire, and then I retired, and then went back, and then I was ready to retire again, and so I've retired 3 times.
Oh, that's fantastic. Interesting, you're talking about the, and I know it's close to your heart, because I know you have pets, and you just lost one of your little Boston Terriers. Not Luna, but...
Luna.
Oh, it was Luna.
It was,
right?
Luna.
The pet loss line.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. That's,
well, it was one of the oldest pet loss hotlines in the country. We ended up closing it, I'm not going to remember the exact year, like 2019, so it mm-hmm. had been around forever. The idea of it was a telephone mm-hmm. and email, and we would get emails from all over the world. And the practicum that I taught was human bereavement and pet loss. And so we taught veterinary students, future veterinarians, about grief, the bond, and human behavior, and just euthanasia process, all kinds of things. So it was a really good practicum course to really get them in to being able to have conversations with their clients someday about really tough subjects, and that they could stay centered and okay. And
right.
So part of the class was that they would do so many hours on the pet loss hotline answering telephone calls and emails.
Mm.
And so they were able to actually respond to people in their grief process. And so my part of the class was really teaching them about the grief process and the different stages of grief as it related to human bereavement and pet loss, and that kind of bridge between those. So it was really fascinating to be able to teach that to them.
Oh, I bet. Are you responsible for that rainbow bridge card that everyone gets after a pet passes away?
No, they have just really good programs at Washington State University Veterinary Medicine. They also have a pastor. I'm not sure if he's called a pastor or...
I'll say a clergyman.
A clergy person in the teaching hospital, which is really a lovely benefit. And there's a counselor in there as well. Mm. And so there's a lot of programming that comes out of the teaching hospital to work with people in their bereavement process.
Yeah, actually, we had a pet potbelly pig, Yogi, who lived for 21 years in our house.
Wow.
She was a house pig. And when she finally got so sick that, you know, it was time, I took her over to WSU because we had taken her there for, like, hoof trims and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the only veterinary around that would do that sort of thing. And, you know, they went in to the thing, told them what was going on, and they confirmed that, you know, she's struggling, so it would be best. And I didn't really want to be in the room because they were going to do what's called a cardiac stick, which lots of cutting and blood and stuff. You know, of course she would be asleep and not feel any of it. But so I went out and I was sitting sobbing in a chair out in the waiting room area, and a woman came out and sat down next to me and was like, "What's up?" and started talking to me, and I kind of figured out she was a counselor of some sort, not just a random person.
Right.
But you know, it was helpful, even if it was a random person. Who cares?
Exactly.
But yeah. So yeah, animal pet grief is. I almost hate to admit it, but both my parents passed away, and about 6 months later, my dog passed away, and I grieved for that dog more than my parents.
I believe it in many ways. And, you know, that's a whole other show we could do on pet loss and grief, because there is a lot to unpack there on how we as a society respond to it, and just how we as humans have that special connection to our animals.
Yeah, for sure. But today we're going to talk a little bit more about humans and working with humans.
If we have to.
Yes. Well, we had an interesting conversation the other day, kind of pre-prep conversation for this, and I proposed a scenario where somebody had a trauma way back when. Could be anything, but I think I picked like sexual assault as a child, and a child being anywhere from 0 to, you know, 18. That children is what I consider being an old guy. And I said, like, you know, when time goes by and years go by, and the effects of that, you know, snowball into bigger and bigger things in the background, I asked you, is like, how do you confront that incident, you know, that beginning incident? And I'll let you explain it again, but, you know, it had to do with dealing with right now first.
Correct. And it does make a difference, the context of why now, like why is somebody either in my office when I was working now, or why are they coming to seek assistance now? And does it have anything to do with what happened to them before? And the other thing, when you talked about a trauma in their background, not everybody labels what happened to them as a trauma, even though they may have a traumatic reaction, and it's intertwined in the effects of what has gone on in their life. And we, looking from the outside in, may be able to say, oh, well, that thing that happened to you when you were 8 that was traumatic for 3 or 4 years had a huge impact on your life. Therefore, all these things that happened when you were a teenager, and the early relationships and your intimacy issues, all of that can be traced back. And that's not necessarily true.
Right.
So it really depends on how the person's narrative is. And so my way of always working with people is definitely meeting them where they are, being respectful to why are they here today, because they may be here for a different reason, even though we've done an intake. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, okay, there's all these marker things that look like trauma, but they're not repeating or reporting them as trauma to me. They're here for something else. It's in their hand. This is what's happening in my current marriage. And yes, all these things have happened to me, but how do I fix this right now that's going on? And so that's not my job to say, well, what do you think about what happened to you when you were 8? You know, we may eventually make connections, and we may not, because to me, the most important thing is building a safety net and resources for the person.
Right.
And so I'm not...
And what do those look like?
Well, what I don't want to do is unpack a lot of material for somebody in 1 hour and then send them out the door without having the ability of a way to repack them.
Right.
So I often talk a lot about containing things and naming things and categorizing them. So while we may not unpack school bullying, we're going to have a box with the label of that.
Right.
We're not going to talk about that, but okay, that's a category. There's things
The safety net.
Well, the safety net then is, as we begin to collect these boxes of things that have happened to this person, I try to teach people kind of a recipe on what happens if one of the lids pop off and you didn't want it to, or you just went ahead one evening and sat down and said, okay, I'm just going to think about this, and got completely overwhelmed. What would you do then? And so the safety net is, if you're at home and you have a partner, can you talk to your partner? Do you have a roommate? Is there somebody that you can call that you feel close to that you can say, hey, I need to talk for a few minutes? Is there music or tea, or do you have a cat or a dog or a pig or something that you could pet that's soothing? And so it's finding different ways to manage and contain whatever is coming up and what is being triggered by things that people go through and feel as they start unpacking some of their past. And then crossing into, when do you reach out for professional help? And so really trying to teach people, when's it an emergency that you call the hospital or you call my crisis line? You know, where down this list of all the things that you've tried do you then need to have some other kind of help, which is 100%. I try to normalize that. There are times that we do need that. And so this is when you would call this number. And so I would have people write this down. We'd have a piece of paper with the resources and kind of a little recipe on what happens if. So that we can feel like we have a plan before we start unpacking some really difficult material.
Right. And yeah, it's like crisis work. You can come in because of you're having suicidal ideation, and it may be related to something that's happening right now.
Correct.
Or it could just be, I'm having these random thoughts of whatever, taking a bunch of pills, you know, using firearms or something. And I don't know why those thoughts keep coming up. And I follow what you're saying about meeting people where they are has to do with a time frame as well. And it's like, right now, I may have neatly stuffed my parents' alcoholic abuse of me in the back, and I go with some friends to shoot pool at Mingles, and there's a loud drunk in there, and suddenly I feel really agitated and angry. So that's like one of those boxes popping open. So I guess you would want to work with people to find a way to diffuse that, so to speak. You know, for me, that particular scenario would probably be like, leave Mingles. You know, as the first thing. But yeah, so, you know, getting down to, I mean, is there really a root of somebody's pain and suffering that you go for? I mean, eventually during the process, or is the root just this pile of stuff that builds up over time?
I think it's all of that. I mean, it's interesting that you said a root, because if we think of a 40-year-old tree, what would the roots look like if you went underground and started looking at that, and they're everywhere and on top of each other and entwined? It would be hard to pull one thread out and say, this is why the leaves are dying. It would be hard to do that. Everything is kind of interconnected. And so for me, I really like to teach people, how do we work with whatever it is, that thing that you do? And so there's this book that I want to write someday. And if anyone's listening that knows me, don't laugh and don't call me, because I'm still trying to figure out how to get this written. But it's
ChatGPT.
Yeah, I know, right? It's called Making Your Dysfunctions Function for You. And so we all have those things that we do, but how can we use that in a more positive way? So there's some things that we as humans, based on what we went through in our life, we just kind of feel like we're stuck with it, and we don't really know what to do with it or how to work with it. But how can we take those skills that may be good skills but aren't serving us well anymore because we're not in that situation where we develop them? So we develop skills and situations that either keep us alive, keep us safe, keep us under the radar, whatever our roles were in our families or relationships or things we had to do to survive certain experiences. Now, doing those things in a situation that is not threatening may just not work. It may be too much or just not a good way to interact with people. However, there's probably things we can pull out of that would be good transferable skills. And that's what I like to look for. I don't want to change people. I want to take what they have and what they built and the resilience factor that got them in front of me in one piece and use that in a way that can give them a healthy way to interact with people in the future.
Right. And actually, one of my skills that came along in my drinking career was I always seemed to be able to come up with a way to earn some money enough to take care of my alcohol addiction and how to, you know, promote myself in doing something. Mm-hmm. For example, my dog had to have an emergency hysterectomy.
Okay.
So I went to my vet, and he told me how much that was going to cost, and I almost fainted. And so I'm sitting in his office, and I look up at the lights because I was working in lighting at that time. And I went, you know, your lights are really kind of bad. And he goes, yeah. He said, I heard something about PG&E has a rebate for doing that. And I said, you know what? I just happen to know all about that. Mm. So let me write up a proposal for you real quick.
An opportunistic.
And see, you know, maybe yes. I can, you buy the materials and I'll just work off the debt for the dog.
Perfect.
And so that's what we ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that was a skill I developed in my drinking. So I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, you know, being a hustler isn't always a bad thing.
No, it is not. They call those entrepreneurs now.
Right. I like hustler. Yeah, kind of a dirty edge.
Of course you do.
No?
Yes.
That's my nature. That is my nature. So we talked a little bit about, you know, how people are going to, you know, figure out what the thing is and a little bit about how to deal with them. What about the next phase? I would think that would be healing. What is the unpacking those boxes and getting those things to go away?
Well,
or
they don't go away.
Right, not go away. I knew as soon as it came out of my mouth, like, no, that's not what I... But
I think of it like... things are woven into our fabric, and sometimes we can use the analogy, it's an old analogy, like a rock in your shoe, you know, like you get comfortable with it after you can find a place where it doesn't hurt so bad. You know, is it on the side? Is it in the front? Is it in the back? Or is it just literally in the middle and you can't walk on it anymore? So it depends on where we are in that process, but I try to think about it as integrating into our experiences, so that we can function with whatever has happened to us. And we're moving. Are we moving forward? I don't know. We might be moving sideways. And we might be moving back and up a little bit to take a better kind of full look at a picture that we're looking at. So I do think that the healing process is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a process where you just go, oh, I'm done. And I feel so much better now. And I'm all healed. And I'm out the door. Thanks for your time. I think we find resting spots where we learn something, which is why we do treatment plans and therapy, so that we have some goals and we know when we've completed goals. Are we feeling good that we can take a rest here? Like, was that the five goals that you wanted to work on? And we've got some good plans, some good education around how to deal with these things. And then if something comes up in the future, come back, find another therapist, continue working on what you may want to unpack in the future. So that's kind of the resting spot, kind of how I look at it, as opposed to I'm finally healed from that.
Right.
I think there's just different ways that we can manage what has happened to us and integrate it into our daily living and relationships where we feel like we're functioning in a more healthy way.
Right. There's people I've known have tend to, I have family members who have been in therapy forever. I mean, for a long time. And I always flash back to, there was a Woody Allen movie called Sleeper, where he goes in for a nose job and everything goes horribly wrong and they freeze him. And they thaw him out 200 years later and they are trying to explain to him how the world has changed. It's become very authoritarian, and people, you know, the robots have taken over doing all the work, so people just have leisure time and all this stuff. But when the doctor's explaining to him, he says, yeah, you've been asleep for 200 years. And he says, 200 years? Do you realize if I've been going to my shrink all this time, I'd almost be cured?
Almost. Oh, no.
So, yeah, it's the sort of thing where you could potentially, like you were saying, hit that resting spot, and then, you know, that agitation comes up again. I experienced that in my recovery from alcoholism a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The example I gave you, the bar and somebody loud in there, you know, that can also reflect back on my drinking career, where like I was a guy who was loud in the bar.
Mm-hmm.
That brings up different feelings and different ways I'm going to look at myself. For me, can drive me into that less than category of, you know, personal observation. Or I can see somebody who's very successful and see a little piece of me in that, and go to the greater than end of the spectrum. Where I like being is in the middle, or as we call it in the program, right size.
Mm-hmm.
So you could reasonably work with somebody on traumas or things in your life for a long time.
Absolutely.
Because they could... I mean, you talked about a resting place, but what if something happens, or say somebody who was a rape victim picks up the newspaper one day and sees a story about rape?
Right.
That can cause some issues, right?
Absolutely. So triggers. And,
triggers, yeah.
And sometimes the thing about... not everyone has PTSD, but one of the things about PTSD is that when you do have a flashback or a trigger of some kind, it could feel like you're in that moment again.
Mm.
Because sometimes our brains, when they store memories, don't necessarily put the timestamp on it.
Right.
So when it pops out, your rational side of you isn't around right at that moment to tell you, oh, hey, don't worry. This memory that you're experiencing right now is 10 years old. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really trying to build, again, those resources and the recipes for what happens. What do you do when that does happen? You know,
right.
And that's teaching grounding techniques, making sure that somebody can sit down and start thinking in a more linear fashion, which gets you out of your amygdala, the monkey brain part that's just screaming fight, flight, freeze, like we're in trouble, get us out of here. When all those memories and feelings just flood back, and the person just feels like they're right there in that moment again, and it's super scary. Lots of adrenaline, hard to tell that you're not in that moment anymore. And so teaching skills to folks about when things like that happen, if you can just grab one thing to think about doing, because it's really hard when you're not online and your rational part of your mind to talk to yourself. You're not going to say, oh, I see you're having a meltdown. You know, no,
that's
not going to happen. However, if you have talked about that before, there just may be one thing that you can grab in that panic state. Oh my gosh, they said, sit down and take your shoes off and feel the floor. It's like, okay, I can do that, you know, and then you begin to move into the ability to maybe think of one other thing, call a person.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend who, her mom was suffering a lot of these mini strokes, and she would get really frightened by them, and she would sit with her and say, you know, mom, look at my face.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Look at my face. Look at the chair over there.
Right.
Touch my hand.
That's
feel
grounding.
My hand.
Yes.
Is it warm? Yeah.
Yes.
And that she said it was like miraculous how quickly she would. And then she eventually was able to do that on her own.
Correct.
When she started feeling one of the strokes or anxiety attacks.
Right.
You know, come on. So, yeah, so I can see how that's That would be, what are some other grounding practices that...
Really, like you were saying, staying in the present to feel things, put your hand on the table and mm-hmm. say what you're doing. I'm feeling the table. My feet are flat on the ground. I feel the back of my legs on the chair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a deep breath. You know, what am I looking at? Where am I? I'm in a room. What day mm-hmm. is it? The idea is to get you to a different part of your brain mm-hmm. and literally moving you to a different part of your brain. So you're thinking more present to help yourself calm down. It's hard when the person is in that panic state and you can hear your heartbeat in your ears and you mm-hmm. you feel almost like you're going to faint, you know, just everything's closing in, to take a deep breath and to sit down and to just try to say where you are. A lot of present kind of grounding techniques are really being literally present.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've experienced panic attacks before. Mm-hmm. So I know that all that, you know, physiology that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the time I never had any tools, you know, really to deal with it. It's just kind of like, write it out, you know.
Well, that's really hard. Sometimes I would have clients write things and put like little notes on the fridge, I mean, or on the mirror in the bathroom. Sometimes if you can't collect your thoughts and I'm staring at the wall, it's like, go to the neighbors. It's like, oh, okay, you know,
yeah.
like just little hints around the house. It depends on how severe someone's having
right.
panic attacks or how close after some crime victims really need a lot of interaction that way to stabilize mm-hmm. them, to just to feel safe in their own house at all.
Right,
so,
right. And that can be, when you say crime victims, you know, rape is not the only physical crime that happens to people. There's assaults, there's menacing, there's all those things that can be involved in it. And it's funny, I think people is like, why is it people sometimes have such a hard time reaching out? And I'm thinking of an example, but you know, it's an extreme one, but you hear about it a lot. It's when women typically are in being abused in a relationship and physically, they tend to not want to reach out, like mm-hmm. to protect the abuser.
Well, sometimes, unfortunately, what we do see is the most dangerous time when a woman is trying or a person's leaving their abusive relationship, that they're killed is when they're leaving.
Right.
And so the psychology of perpetrators is a whole different show again, but
mm-hmm.
there was some early studies done with domestic violence abusers that really just are feeling very insecure and feel like they will die without that other person.
Mm-hmm.
And so that idea of, if you're leaving, I feel like I'm going to die. So we do see murders happen in those scenarios.
Right.
And so I think for folks trying to leave an abusive relationship, it's dicey, and that is why we have alternatives to violence, and we have other help in our community for people to start talking and trying to understand how can you do that in a safe way. It isn't just like, oh, he smacked me, and now I'm leaving because I'm not going to put up with that. It's complicated, and it's like the frog in the boiling pot.
Right.
It's not like you're getting the snot whooped out of you, you know, once. It's a slow process, and you're readjusting, and it's your relationship, and you're trying to make things work, and it's not the person's fault for staying. And mm-hmm. I think we as a society do a real harm for blaming that person, and I think we help keep them in those situations in some instances as a society because of what we put on people. And so I think it's very hard to leave, and we can think of incidences here in our own community where when people were trying to find a better way for themselves, that they did not make it out alive.
Right.
So there's that thought. And so I think it's complicated, it's layered, and there is a lot to think about and unpack when you're thinking about leaving an abusive relationship.
Right.
As far as people reaching out for help for other things, I think it really puzzles people when someone can be assaulted and harmed in some way, and then they go home. Or I worked with a woman who in California years ago who had been assaulted and by a stranger, and so it wasn't someone she knew, where she had any ties or complication, but she was so much in shock that she went to the laundromat afterwards and didn't report till the next day. And so that gets hard. You know, we've done a better job working with law enforcement, and law enforcement has grown a million miles from the 80s to where we are now, where they can understand victimology and victim behavior when people are in shock and they do things that don't look logical to us looking in from the outside. Like, why don't you just run to the police? I mean, you know, people just, we don't know. And we don't know what has happened in a person's life to shut them down in that moment when they've been harmed, because that's how they stayed safe. They just shut everything down and went to a quiet place. So we don't know. And so that's, you know, that's another thing about meeting people where they are and trying to understand, why are they reacting this way now? It's more like, how can we get through the way you're reacting now? Because we might not have time to sit here and talk about 20 years of your life to figure out why. So how? How is really where I always jump to when people are like, why'd this happen? I don't know, actually. Really, I don't know why it happened. We could look at that at some point, but right now, how can we move through the rest of this day?
Yeah, I know a person who was actually a highway patrol officer, and on a felony stop, one of the people they were getting out of the car came up with a weapon, and he was forced to shoot and kill that person. Well, most people know, you know, when law enforcement, when there's a shooting incident, you know, they put them on leave until an investigation is done. Well, he went in, did his report, did his interview with his superiors, and they put him out on leave. Well, 2 days later, it's like his fellow officers were like trying to contact him. This was pre-cell phone. They're trying to contact him. He's not getting any response, and they started getting worried. They went by his place. He wasn't home. His car wasn't there. And they were really getting worried. And at the office, a Catholic priest called their office and said, do you know a gentleman named such and such? And they're like, yeah. And he goes, he's been in our sanctuary for the last 2 days, and I don't think he's okay.
Oh, man.
So they were able to send one of their mental health people, which I was amazed the Highway Patrol had that built into their system, down to sit and talk with them in that environment. It was kind of weird because he was like raised a Lutheran, so a Catholic church was a little weird, but
they're related.
Yeah, right. They are. And so he, you know, was able to talk with that person and kind of get grounded and move forward. And then, of course, they recommended that, you know, during this process, which could take weeks to months to evaluate, even though it seemed pretty clear cut at the time to everyone involved, that he do some counseling. And he was fortunate he was not one, even though he was raised in my generation, which has the most screwed up view of mental health on earth. Yeah, you know, rub some dirt in it. Oh, well, that's really going to help the fact that my dad beat me. He was willing to do the work and go through the process, and he was able to go back to work and not suffer from PTSD or crippling PTSD, I should say. I'm sure he suffered from it somewhat, but, you know, he was able to go back and do his job. You know, a lot of police officers spend an entire career and never draw their weapon. You know, that's the norm, if people don't realize. So when something goes down where somebody has to draw their weapon and somebody is going to die, that can be really tough.
It can be really tough. And the whole idea of, you know, them or me. I mean, you had to make a choice and choose yourself. And that is hard. It's hard to integrate that into being well again. So I'm glad that counseling worked for that person.
Hey, you know what? Speaking of counseling working, we're up against the clock here.
All right.
I'm going to tease this and say that this is not going to be the last time you hear from Dr. Russo. We were talking before the show about coming back and maybe doing a kind of an interesting program. I'll just say, sit, stay, and talk. And you can just think about that out there, and we'll get together and do it one of these days. So I want to thank you, Valerie, for coming in and spending the time. There's some great information in there, and I'm glad you were able to share it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I'll close this up my usual way. If you think you have a problem with behavioral health or substance abuse, you do.